want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your host is humbled by the people who support this program by subscribing. And today, within a 15-minute period, we saw three new signups. I'm very grateful. My thanks to Toddish Durbin, Joao Filho, and Becky Messer. I mean, without you, this would be Radio Nowhere. We've got an exclusive interview for you today with Sabrina D'Souza. She kept her silence for years as a CIA operative who was part of the team that pulled off the bungled caper in Milan, Italy in 2003, the snatching of Abu Omar. She was later convicted in absentia in Italy and has been essentially disowned by the CIA. It's a painful story for her to tell, but she is blowing the whistle, in particular calling for accountability for the decision makers, right up to President George W. Bush, who authorized that operation in Italy in 2003. We've got the full story straight ahead here on the Peter B. Collins podcast. But first, I want to thank those folks who did become new subscribers today, Toddish, Joao, and Becky. I really appreciate your support, and you're setting an example for others who can go to peterbcollins.com, click on the links that say sign up right under my mugshot in the upper left-hand corner. And at PayPal, you can choose a $1 subscription, gets you a 24-hour pass, $5 a month, you can cancel anytime, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And for new annual subscribers, I've still got some bags of that great-smelling Kona coffee that Russ sent over from Hawaii. And it goes along with the Sibel Edmonds Classified Woman bonus book. For new subscribers, get all the details and take action now. I'd really appreciate it at peterbcollins.com. The other way you can support our efforts here is by doing business with GoDaddy.com. When you need to register a domain name or set up a website, maybe you want to move your hosting to save money. Have you heard about this deal? $1.99 a month for unlimited storage and bandwidth with web hosting and a free domain name. How can you beat that? Well, you can if you click on the link for the special deal that's in the show file for this podcast at peterbcollins.com, and we'll throw in an extra 10% off web hosting if you follow that link today.
The story is true. Dragnet.
Yes, the story you're about to hear is true. And the Dragnet was a CIA rendition from the streets of Milan on February 17th, 2003. The subject, an Egyptian named Abu Omar, who was on his way to midday prayers at a mosque in midtown Milan when he was picked up and kidnapped by a crew of Americans, mostly affiliated with the Central Intelligence Agency. To this date, the primary information that we've had on this case was generated in a book called A Kidnapping in Milan, The CIA on Trial, written by Steve Hendricks. And we've interviewed Steve twice, most recently in February of this year. If you'd like to find that podcast, it's available. Just to go to the search window and, say, put in Abu Omar at peterbcollins.com. But over the past few days, we've learned a great deal more about this bungled episode. And I want to credit Jonathan Landay, a great reporter at the McClatchy Washington Bureau, who broke this story and was kind enough to put me in contact with the subject. She is Sabrina D'Souza, who was working for the CIA and was not actually in Milan on the day of the kidnapping, which I think is a critical point. But she has been essentially cast aside by our government, which has refused to acknowledge her diplomatic immunity, which she claims and seems like a fair claim to me. And while others in the case, Robert Lady, the Milan station chief who was intercepted in Panama and might have been subject to the warrant for his arrest issued by Italy, the United States permitted him to come back home, and we haven't heard anything further about whether there will be any cooperation with the authorities in Italy. And likewise, the commander of the airbase at Aviano, Colonel Joseph Romano, who was also, like Sabrina, convicted in absentia by Italian courts, was given a pardon by the president of Italy this past April under pressure from the United States. But Sabrina D'Souza is not being given that kind of special treatment. If anything, she has exhausted all of the official channels and has now gone public to describe the problems that she has had. Sabrina, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you.
Now, if you would quickly sum up for our listeners, what is your status and why have you gone public with your description of this caper in Milan and the subsequent treatment of people like you?
Well, I'm currently not working for the CIA. I resigned in 2009, and I can explain the circumstances around my resignation. But to answer your other question, and a lot of people have asked me this, why now? It's been a long process for me, but as a federal employee, I knew what my obligations were. And I went through all the proper channels with my organization, as well as all the way up to Senator Feinstein's office, from whom I had disclosed the wrongdoing, which we will go into in a little bit. This takes a lot of time, as you can imagine, in Washington. It took me 5 long years to even get through this entire process, and I wanted to make sure it was done correctly and that I exhausted every avenue available to me. And I guess this is important these days when people talk about Snowden and Bradley Manning and whether they had options of going through proper channels. So where I was concerned, the system of going through the proper channels to disclose wrongdoing, which I eventually did, never worked for me. And the last person who had this information, and the only person who had this information on the House Intelligence Committee, was Senator Feinstein's office. And when I went ahead and disclosed to her exactly what happened after the rendition and before the rendition, I never heard back at all. It would have been great to have heard from her saying, okay, we are looking into it or something. You see what I mean? To make me feel like there was going to be an investigation.
Well, Sabrina, let's take a moment here to talk about Senator Feinstein. I have known her since she was mayor of San Francisco, all the way back to the 1980s. Mm-hmm. And I have seen what has happened when other whistleblowers, and you may bristle at the term, we'll talk about that as well, but brought important information to her, notably Mark Klein. He was the AT&T technician who revealed the secret switch in San Francisco that really was the first indication that I had about the massive interception of Americans' communications. He went to Senator Feinstein, who then turned his information over to the NSA. And also, he went to the LA Times, and I'll name names here. The editor he talked to was Dean Baquet, who now works for the New York Times. And likewise, instead of publishing the information that Klein brought, he turned it over to the Senate Intelligence Committee. So you must know, you're a smart person, you've worked as an undercover operative abroad, you know how the system works, and you've seen the examples that have been made of Tom Drake, of Manning, who was convicted right before your revelations were published. And we have Ed Snowden, who has left the terminal or the transit zone in Moscow now with a one-year asylum, but the White House is flatly saying he's not a whistleblower, he's a criminal. So with that record, it's got to be really scary for you to go public and not know how you will be retaliated against.
It's true. I don't know how I will be retaliated against, and I'm sure it's coming down the line. But 2 points over here. One, you know, Senator Feinstein is the chair of the Oversight Committee. So I had to go up to that level, at least to say I went there. There's a letter, there's a document there to her disclosing everything. I didn't want to take an example of what had happened before to say, okay, I'm not doing it because it never worked before. You know what I mean?
Sure.
So I decided to do that.
You had to check off the box.
I checked off the box not once, twice, thrice. In fact, when this letter went to Senator Feinstein, I went one additional step further. I went to Human Rights First, and I got them to send a letter to Senator Feinstein's office saying, please, you must listen to this woman. We are not able to take any classified information. She's not giving it to us, but she has a good case over here. It involves the torture of Abu Omar, alleged torture. It's a human rights violation. This is your job as a chairman of the Oversight Committee. Please listen to her. And David Granis, her EA, did not want to do that. So he said, write the letter, which is a good thing. I wrote the letter and I hand-delivered it to Granis. My attorney was not involved in it because it was sensitive enough that I felt she should get it directly, okay? Mm-hmm. So I did everything I had to do. Now, the way I feel, and I've thought about this a lot in the last few days with Bradley Manning and with Snowden, I feel my case is a little different in the sense of I'm a grain of sand in, you know, but what I disclosed was a grain of sand. What they disclosed was really sand dunes, you know, in terms of the amount of what they had disclosed. I would never have the courage to do that, you know, to go out and just do all that. For me, there was enough wrongdoing in my case. There was a tiny bit of policy, which is diplomatic immunity, and that immediately got thrown out of the courts in the U.S. But my little portion that was that related to wrongdoing that led to the torture of Abu Omar, took him out of a legal judicial process in Italy, was a completely unnecessary rendition, and was now, and I got convicted for it. He's in limbo, and the head of an intelligence service in Italy is being prosecuted when he absolutely said no to this rendition. So my case is not disclosure, you know, of course, of huge amounts of technical information or programs. Now, a program, yes, the rendition program that no one has openly talked about. But in this rendition program, I'm talking about one thing, mm-hmm. of which I know everything. I mean, people ask me, well, what about this rendition, that rendition? You know, you have to believe that in the agency, every single one of these is so compartmented, no one else would have access to mm-hmm. to another rendition. So for me, I felt, I know that there's going to be problems, but I felt I had to do this and take this kind of risk because it involved, you know, a huge violation which was covered up for the last 7 years by our country and Italy as well.
And Sabrina, I've been a sharp critic of Senator Feinstein on many issues, but I don't let that blind me completely, at least I hope not. And to her credit, she is trying to get a declassified summary of the 6,000-page report, $40 million worth of research, into the rendition and torture programs. And so it did make sense. And I'm not judging you or being critical that you went to Feinstein, because I respect that you wanted to try to exhaust all channels. But she, likewise, has constraints because since February, when that report was completed, I believe she is sincere in trying to find ways to at least declassify portions of it. And we've been told in a summary fashion from her and others that flatly the torture program didn't produce actionable intelligence, did not directly lead to the location of Osama bin Laden, and so that the claims of its efficacy are faulty. And further, while that study remains classified, the Open Society Institute published a report showing that as many as 130, do I have that number right, 131 individuals were kidnapped in this fashion, and that some 51 countries either collaborated with the U.S. in snatching these people or allowed overflight of our torture taxis through their airspace. So that gives us some dimensions in a broad sketch of these efforts. What you have is detailed information of a single rendition case. So let's now talk about the issues that began with the event of February 17th, 2003, and was the culmination of the monitoring of Abu Omar by both American covert operators and by Italian special police. And there was a joint effort underway, and from what I can piece together, it was Castelli, who was the station chief in Rome, and I guess he oversaw all operations in Italy. Is that a fair inference? And you worked for him in Rome, right?
I was assigned in Rome before I went to Milan, correct?
Yes, but you were based in Rome, and it was almost incidental or accidental that you went to Milan and got involved with this to begin with, right?
Well, yeah, the slot opened up unexpectedly because an officer couldn't fill it, and instead of sending someone off to language training another whole year and things like that, I was supposed to leave Rome to come back to the U.S. And they asked me, since I had language and everything, I knew what was going on in Italy, to go take that position. And this happened before 9/11. And the reason I bring that up is because one of the charges against me was she was responsible for, devoting resources to this. And if it wasn't for her, okay, it would never have happened. Which, of course, only the President of the United States okays these things.
Well, were you an advocate for the rendition of Abu Omar? From the descriptions I've picked up, you didn't really have a role in that decision.
Well, there was no, number one, just for your readers to get some background, the program itself would not have come to anyone's attention around the world at the time because it was so much information had not been available. Remember, this is in right after 9/11, right? 2001, 2002.
Well,
so
and it's important to note that we were all distracted with the run-up to the invasion of Iraq at this time. And so when this occurred, of course, it was covert, and even the Italians didn't know for a week or two that Abu Omar had disappeared. So there was a fog of war that obscured much of what was going on at this time.
Yeah, but the point I was going to try and make was officers in the CIA would not have known about a program called a rendition program. Officers in the CIA would not have known about a program called waterboarding. You see what I mean? All of that came out in the press later. So for me, sitting in Milan, right after 9/11, I had no idea there was a program called the rendition program. Till Castelli, and Castelli would have been the first one to know it, any very senior person saying, hey, this is an option for terrorists in your area of responsibility, and this is perhaps something you should consider. And he decided to consider that, which is why he went and explained it to the Italians. Really quickly, the Italians said, you say we have a dangerous territory, terrorist in our midst. Why then? We must do something about it. And then they initially went out to investigate what was going on. We had a team come down. I served as a translator for that. And then the head of Italian intelligence, the one who's being prosecuted right now, General Polari, came back and made 3 points right away. Just as background, for a rendition to take place in Italy, being a NATO country, the President of the United States has to authorize it, and the head of the country, in that case Berlusconi, had to authorize it, had to agree to it, mm-hmm. as had SISMI, the head of intelligence. So Polari came back and said, Berlusconi absolutely said no, not happening. The Intelligence Reform Act in Italy did not allow such programs to, you know, for SISMI to work on such programs. And maybe once it was passed, they could revisit the idea again. And then finally, what SISMI didn't know, which is quite common, right? Remember over here, FBI doesn't know what the CIA is doing sometimes, you see, in terms of operations. SISMI did not know at the time when they started this investigation that DIGOS, the Italian police, had Abu Omar under investigation for 2 years. Mm-hmm. So immediately they said, oh, now we really can't do anything because we cannot disrupt an ongoing investigation.
Now, Steve Hendricks describes Castelli as just determined, due to personal ambition, to conduct a rendition, any rendition.
He wanted
a rendition stripe. I don't know, do you get special badges, or is there a bonus in your paycheck if you do a rendition? What was he angling for? It sounds like he was trying to keep up with bureau chiefs around the world.
Yeah, and he was possibly trying to keep up with bureau chiefs around the world. I can't say what was in his head, but obviously after all this, a rendition would have looked good on his evaluation, right? Because it's a difficult thing to do, and you're doing it in Europe. But here's the thing, Peter. These renditions really were taking place other than Europe, a lot of them. They were, of course, flying over Europe, because in Europe, Their laws, they have strict laws, you know, against what meets the threshold for a prosecution. And it is not a country that doesn't have a legal system in place, however draconian it may be or whatever. There are countries that, you know, Europeans have different laws from us. Their you know, what they can present in court is completely different. So DIGOS could not find enough of a threshold to arrest Abu Omar. You see,
mm-hmm.
there wasn't a threshold for that. So doing a rendition in Europe, plus getting the approval of the head of the country, the head of intelligence, you know, was difficult, because they're going to turn around and say, now, wait a minute, why do we? And that's a question one would ask, anyone would ask, you would ask. Now, why would you take someone out of Italy that has a judicial, that has a legal system in place? He is already under investigation. Why not arrest him and talk to him there? Why not detain him and talk to him there? You want to flip him, like, you know, you want to recruit him? Go ahead and do it right there. You want to threaten him in any way? Go ahead and do it. Why do you have to take him to a country that the United States knows full well? Because all these approvals took place all the way back in Washington. That is on State Department's list of countries that tortured.
Well, and Abu Omar was from Egypt. He had fled and attained asylum in Italy, and he claims he had been tortured before he left Egypt. So, you know, this is all mind-boggling on so many levels. But, Sabrina, you have provided new information that I think is very important. And in particular about Castelli, the chief in Rome, the guy who wanted a rendition on his resume. And that is that he whipsawed both the Italians and his bosses at headquarters in Langley, because he told the CIA bosses that he had winks and nods from his Italian counterparts, that they wouldn't go on the record and approve this publicly or put it in writing. But he basically lied to his superiors that he had buy-in from the Italians. And then he lied to the Italians, saying that, and also to the Egyptians, saying that he had evidence against Abu Omar that justified his kidnapping, or rendition is the term they use. So these are important disclosures that give us a much better understanding of who's actually responsible for this and how it went so badly off track.
Okay, just one comment. The wink, wink, nod, nod thing was my description, I guess, of what Castelli did. But Castelli's thing was, there's nothing in writing, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is a tacit, he claimed was a tacit approval from SISMI.
Right.
There's no document over there, so it was one of these, you know. So that was really my description of it that I guess McClatchy decided to put in. But there's nothing in writing, and it was his interpretation, so all the gray area, you know. Sismi says no. And of course, Sismi had no information, by the way, on Abu Omar, because that information lay with the police. The CIA, to make a case for it, came up with what the Italian police had. But again, there weren't any documents or anything like that. All those things were released later on, the telephone taps and everything were released in court documents. So at the time, there really wasn't a document that says, here is the evidence. It was all, you know, this, he's a possibly and, you know, a really dangerous person and all the rest of it. So that was what was, that was the message that Langley got. My question over there then becomes, how come no one did any due diligence in Langley enough? Okay, now you've seen that there were other officers from the CIA who corroborated what I said in terms of their recollection that there was a lot of concern in Washington over this rendition. And they eventually got strong-armed into providing the approval. They went up to Rice, and she was all concerned about it as well. So there was concern. And again, people had Michael Scheuer, who's the expert on rendition, said he had never heard of Abu Omar before. Mm-hmm. No one had ever heard. And renditions are meant for high-value targets.
Right. And you know, we're now seeing these rationalizations and apologies that, oh, gosh, you know, we were so freaked out by 9/11 that we just had to do something. And, of course, Dick Cheney set the tone by talking about the dark side. And so, you know, I can understand any kind of aggressive action to go after those we thought were responsible for 9/11. But this appeared to be just a kind of dragnet approach and a desire to get a trophy, even though Abu Omar, not a saint, he was dialing for dollars, it appears, to raise money for some sort of jihadi projects, but he had not crossed a line where he was actively involved with some sort of known plot. And that's the threshold that you referred to a little bit earlier. So,
and the Italians would have picked him up.
Yes.
If he was.
And they're our allies. It's not a situation, you know, where we couldn't rely on Italy to properly investigate or prosecute a case like this. So it was a Bigfoot move by the United States and a big blunder on the part of Castelli, who put these forces in motion.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And this goes back to what I call the buddy system, you know. Hey, you know, we're going to work outside the framework. Well, you know, it doesn't really meet it, but okay, all go ahead and do it. You know, what happened in Khost in Afghanistan, and your viewers, you could, you know, it's about the 7 CIA officers who got killed.
Yeah.
Okay. There, you know, Panetta came out and said, oh, we're putting in all these protocols and new procedures in place. Come on, you know, the CIA has been doing, this kind of work for so long. There are procedures in place. What happened over there was they went outside the framework of security,
mm-hmm.
providing access. Normally, everyone who came into the compound, there was a procedure to follow. They opted not to follow the procedure. That's what happens when any operation works outside established guidelines.
And Sabrina, in the bigger picture, isn't this also the shift in mission? Because the CIA is supposed to be an intelligence gathering and an analytic agency. But it was given paramilitary duties following 9/11 to operate covertly and to capture, kill, and detain people. And I believe that that's a fundamental mistake that needs to be corrected. Because I value the honest work of the CIA. I don't approve of the paramilitary role. And, you know, starting with George Tenet, the kind of mission creep that we have some knowledge of, and you have much more than I do, gives me great concern.
Well, it is something to be concerned about, and you're absolutely right. I mean, the mission pre-9/11 was, you know, what the CIA was built for, what the officers were trained for. And this paramilitary function became new. But also as our country, as soon as 9/11 happened, we just had this knee-jerk reaction where we're going to go out and do it all. But no one ever talked about legal aspects of it, the ramifications, the and especially more so now that we see the impact on anti-American sentiment. No one's talked about that. And really the chickens are coming home to roost on this, not only in just the Abu Omar case, but everywhere. You know, all this thing. And also the message we send around the world. For example, you know, when I hear the term, these programs are in place, these controversial programs are in place because it saves American lives, right?
Yeah.
So across the world, when we go in and we hunt down one person and we engage in a form of neighborhood cleansing with, you know, everyone that around that person gets, is dead, women, children, everyone, the message that's heard across the world is, oh, so your lives are better than ours. Is that it? You see what I mean? And how does that help us in the long run? How does that help us be safe as a country? This has become one big, horrible, vicious circle. That's it, you know?
Well, Sabrina, this is a very powerful statement, and I appreciate it from you. Are you familiar with the late Professor Chalmers Johnson, who coined the term blowback? Because that's what you're describing.
No, it really is a blowback, and it should really concern us. It really should concern us because, you know, anti-American sentiment is at an all-time high. And what I fear, having served as a diplomat overseas, and then you see what happened in Benghazi, is, you know, anger against these policies directed at the United States is then turned around and directed at those who are most vulnerable and accessible, the people serving in our military, in our bases, in our embassies. That's why you have Ambassador Stevens, you see, dead for a decision made in Washington. Mm-hmm. Abu Omar, Bob Lady gets arrested for a bad decision made in Washington.
Bob Lady, by the way, the Milan station chief.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yeah. And absolutely, the United States did exactly what it should do and get him out of that situation, because at the end of the day, it's so ridiculous. Here's the one person who was so adamant against it, was so concerned about it. You know, he even tried to go to the Italian intelligence chief in Milan saying, hey, please go tell your people that, you know, this is not a good thing to stop it, after Cizmi pulled out of it. And he's the one who's, you know, suffered a great deal over this whole thing. And the ones who really authorized it, they're all here in Washington. I mean, this is classic Washington cover-up.
Yes. And you're disposable.
Yeah, the scapegoatry, you know, it starts off with, oh, how are we going to protect self-preservation? And then, oh, let's look around and see who we can scapegoat in this whole sorry affair. And for me, you know, it's really been difficult. But, you know, why does my mother have to suffer for it? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Why was she held hostage and not in the situation where, you know, I had to choose between my job and her? And my retirement and her. I mean, you know, it's the job.
Explain that, Sabrina, because you lost your retirement benefits at the CIA because you were under orders not to leave the country, and you defied that order so that you could visit your mother and also, I believe, your dying father.
Yes, yes, correct. And it was an indefinite ban. You know, I come, especially from a culture where family and, you know, they knew nothing about what was going on.
Well, and let me just interject. You're a naturalized American citizen, but you are from Goa in India.
From India, correct, yes. And, you know, it was, you know, they'd never heard of a rendition. The only rendition, you know, and familiar to anyone over there would be something out of an opera or something like that, and not a U.S. policy. And also the one thing, you know, my parents were so happy when I became a diplomat. It was like, oh, wow, you know, our daughter is a diplomat. And then my mother couldn't quite figure out. I mean, you worked for this prestigious job, because I remember they came to visit me in Italy, being very Catholic, you know, the Vatican's right there and stuff.
Yeah.
And she couldn't figure out how, a country like, the country that I'm serving over here would, as a diplomat of all things, I wasn't like, you know, some low level nothing anywhere that could not protect me at the end.
Now, could you explain for us, I don't really understand exactly how it works, and there may be limits on what you can disclose, but in general terms, you are described as a diplomat, you're given diplomatic cover, but I believe you got your paycheck from the CIA while you were overseas described as a State Department person. How does that work?
I think that's best left to State Department to kind of go through, or the CIA. But, you know, when we are assigned overseas, and I guess you've seen, numerous instances of CIA officers who, you know, I guess their cover's blown because of whatever incidents that take place, mm-hmm. you know, overseas. But, you know, when you're assigned to an embassy, you're assigned as part of the mission, the diplomatic mission. And it doesn't matter who, which organization it is, you're part of a diplomatic mission. And then you're accredited to that country and given the immunities and protection. The country agrees to give you those immunities and protections. And the Italians knew exactly who I was, and they all admitted that in their court documents, because I wasn't like, working sort of, what you can say, like an undercover person over there, in a sense.
You didn't wear wigs and have a plastic face disguise, like Mission Impossible.
No, none of that. No, the Italians knew exactly who I was, and that was our official relationship that I had with the Italians. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like, you know, I'd go there and say, hey, I'm, you know, from this company, or I'm, you know, so-and-so from the embassy. But to be
like we know that Valerie Plame had a cover as an executive with a company that you know, she traveled under that cover when she went overseas. You didn't have that kind of arrangement.
No, I didn't have that kind of. I was absolutely a U.S. government official assigned in mm-hmm. Italy, and the Italians knew full well. It's all in Italian court documents.
Right.
At any rate, but pretty much. But you know, Italy has a problem here because it's a bilateral agreement. Status of forces, which is the colonel who got pardoned, and diplomatic and the Vienna Convention are bilateral agreements. And Italy, as a country, is unable to honor those agreements because of their judiciary. And that doesn't just apply to U.S. diplomats; it applies to all their diplomats serving in Italy. You see. And actually, they're kind of looking down the edge of the sword that they imposed on when they convicted us, because there's a case going on in India, which is a reason why I think the colonel got pardoned. You know, you had two Italian Marines who killed two Indian fishermen. They were arrested. They were allowed to leave the country, but they were supposed to come back and stand trial. And the Italian ambassador, Daniele Mancini, agreed to it. So when they never returned, obviously, the ambassador told the Indians, hey, you know, they're not returning. And the Indians said, but you said, you know, you told us in writing or whatever that they're going to return. And he said, no, they're not. I changed my mind. And they said, well, then you're not going to leave the country. And he said, I have diplomatic immunity. And I was in India at the time. I almost fell off my chair going, really? And so they said, no, you don't have diplomatic immunity. And they sealed their borders. And in 2 days, the Marines returned, and they're still there waiting for trial.
Well, and Sabrina, I know that you are sympathetic to Bob Lady, and I don't make any personal judgment about him, but he is the subject of a warrant from Italy. And it's just a little bit hypocritical for the U.S. to protect him when he was intercepted in Panama and no extradition request had been made. I guess there isn't even a treaty. At any event, while the Ed Snowden situation is underway and we're pleading with the Russians to return him despite the lack of any kind of extradition agreement there, we don't really have much credibility in this respect, do we?
No, but I think the most amazing statement I ever heard that I never thought would ever come out of our country is, send him back, we promise not to torture him. I mean, for crying out aloud, are you serious?
Yeah, yeah, I was
United
stunned.
States to make that, to have to say that? Really? I mean,
yeah,
it's such a sad state.
Really. We're talking with Sabrina D'Souza here on the Peter B. Collins Show, a former CIA employee, and as you've heard, she was posted in Italy at the time of the rendition of Abu Omar in February of 2003. And Sabrina, just to quickly recap, you have added, as I said, important issues to our knowledge of this episode and its aftermath regarding Castelli's double dealing with the Italians and with his bosses in the United States, and also some other details. But to me, the central issue here is that you have been left exposed and now without a pension, and those who approve this at the very top are not even identified as responsible. There's this wink and nod game where we pretend that Condoleezza Rice didn't personally approve this, that George Tenet, then the CIA director, did not personally approve this, and there should be a record of George W. Bush's approval of this operation, and they are not being held to account in any way, shape, or form, and yet your life is in some set of shambles, and you're subject to arrest if you get within extraditable range of Italy.
Of Europe. In Europe.
The entire European community,
yes. Yeah, that's true. But, you know, the one thing that came out of the European Court of Human Rights on the Carla Dal Mastri case, which, as you know, the ACLU brought to the Supreme Court and it was thrown out on state secrets. The only state secret I could see over there was the identities of those who messed up that one as well. But, you know, they said that they really don't need any classified information anymore. And that was a huge decision that was made, from my understanding of it, which is, you know, you should have known or would have known by nature, by because of your position. And, you know, the CIA is a hierarchical structure. I mean, everything has to go through a chain of command, particularly something so big. And each of these officers in the CIA, by their own admission, say who they were, who they worked for, and what position they had, and they've disclosed all this in books they've written, interviews they've been through, and in the media. So you really don't need classified information to show where the chain of command was. You could follow it all the way. In fact, just to let you know too, Michael Scheuer in 2005 disclosed the name of Castelli, his role, his to the Italian press, and his function. Of James Pavitt, who was the chief of the NCS, and Tenet as being responsible for this. Mm-hmm. Yet, the Italians never bothered to add them to the list, considering that you don't need much evidence in Italy to prosecute people. And that's because the minute Tenet's name would have come up over there, you know, the U.S. would never have allowed him to be prosecuted.
Mm-hmm. Well, he got the...
And that's the thing...
He got the Medal of Freedom. That gives him immunity for life, right?
Yeah, in the United States. But they've always pressured. See, the Spaniards started the investigation against the Bush senior. And everyone's tried to do it in Europe, but they've never kind of gotten anywhere because the U.S. threatens them with cooperation, mm-hmm. right? So they kind of quietly go away. But, you know, that's a lot of posturing in Europe. That's the thing that I find a little bit hypocritical is, you know, all the chest beat. For example, this Abu Omar rendition was supposed to be this big violation of Italy's sovereignty, and they went on and on about it. Yet the government of Italy not once asked the United States to acknowledge it even happened. I mean, how is that possible? You see?
Yeah. Now, in the article written about you by Jonathan Landay, he makes a couple of references to commentary from Condoleezza Rice. She was the president's national security advisor in 2003 and the point person at the White House for the deliberations over whether to proceed with the kidnapping of Abu Omar. And it is cited and attributed to you that she is reported to have said, you know, what happens if the operation fails, and was told, well, they'll just deport the CIA people from Italy.
PNG, yeah.
And so her personal involvement, is there any way to prove that? And by the way, if you want to declare that you don't have any documents you're supposed to have, you're not supposed to have right now, you can do that.
Yeah, I didn't. But the thing is, there wasn't any need for that. I'd like to address that point right away. There wasn't any need for me to take out any documents because the only purpose for me to disclose this was going to be to Senator Feinstein's office and to the Congress, all of whom had the clearances and could have taken my information and gone to the CIA and said, explain and give us the documents. You see mm-hmm. what I mean? So there was no need for me to come out with any documents on this at the end of the day.
All right. So you have no documents, but do you believe that in the CIA files there would be memos, for example, from Condoleezza Rice that reflect these discussions that you have reported on?
There should be. I frankly don't know. I'm just citing, messages that went back from CIA to Rome, asking them to clarify all these issues. The issues of, what happens, who's going to protect these people. Are you sure this needs to be done? Because there was a lot of concern about whether to even do this rendition or not from Langley, because it didn't seem to meet the threshold that was required.
And so what messages are you aware of that came from Washington to either Rome or Milan to green light the operation, and whose name is attached to that approval?
I can't remember exact names of individuals, but it would have to be officers, you see. The ones would have been the, deputy director of the NCS, the chief of the Europe division, the counterterrorism center, and all those would have had to approve those messages all the way up for something like this. Mm-hmm. Now, the names of anyone else are irrelevant to this. I'm looking at the accountability of the individuals who were in a position to authorize this.
Well, and that's what I'm driving at. Was there ever a mention that, well, the President POTUS has approved this, the White House has signed off?
Yeah. No, the fact that it happened was a testimony that the White House had signed off on it. Otherwise, it couldn't have taken place, because only the President can sign off on these, on renditions.
Okay, but with the duplicity on the part of Castelli, is it possible that George Tenet pocketed this and gave approval without actually asking the White House?
No, that had to go up, because remember I said it's a NATO country. It requires that level of approval.
Well, I want to believe that. I'm just not sure that protocols have always been followed, and so skepticism is warranted.
Yeah, you can be skeptical about it, but it had to be done by all the way up to the National Security Council. That much I know.
Okay. Yeah. Now, Sabrina, I'd like to turn to the events of February 17th, 2003, because the spy craft that was exhibited by your colleagues, and I want to point out once again that you were not in Milan on February 17th. You've got a great alibi. You were skiing with your son. Is that right?
Correct.
Yeah.
It was White Week.
Okay. So the CIA operatives stayed in first-class hotels in Milan. Some of them used their real names so that they could get bonus mileage credit for the $750 a night hotel rooms they were staying in. The CIA operatives used standard cell phones, and it was the SIM cards of those phones and the identity locations that they gave off that allowed the Italian prosecutor to piece together the evidence that was used to convict you in absentia. And there are other angles here. This was done in broad daylight. There was a witness who observed the moment when Abu Omar was detained and then physically and brutally forced into this white van. These really seem like Keystone Cops tactics, being, billed to the taxpayers at the highest possible price. And I'm really offended that our, vaunted Central Intelligence Agency was operating at such a slipshod level.
Yeah, and, quite frankly, all of that information actually surfaced later on in court records and the Italian media, which had covered it extensively. Of course, I didn't know what transpired on the street, nor, how they performed till after what happened. And, you're right, and a lot of it could have been because, they were told, hey, they would have, to be told this is a really dangerous terrorist, that's why we're taking them off the streets, and secondly that, the Italians have our backs, so hey, if the Italians know about this, they may have felt there is no need to be so cautious or something, but at the end of the day, it talks about the professional level of an organization, mm-hmm. that is supposed to be first class, that is supposed to invest a lot in training and, how to conduct operations and overseas as well. So, it doesn't make anyone look very good, obviously.
And Sabrina, you can appreciate that as an observer and somebody who cares about these issues, I know a fair amount now about the episode in Milan. And it is riddled with arrogance, the arrogance of Castelli to try to play the Italians, try to play his own bosses, the arrogance of the operatives to be so sloppy as we just described, the arrogance to believe that they could simply get away with this. And my question is that level of arrogance really in evidence across the entire CIA operation? Is there this sense of entitlement and exceptionalism that we can do no wrong, and if we do, nobody will be held accountable?
There are two parts to that question. One, I don't think there's this huge arrogance all the way across. There are people who do good work in there and, you know, take it all seriously and, you know, do what they're supposed to be doing. And then there are others who are, like you said, the keystone cops. The other part of it is the culture of secrecy that does not allow wrongdoing to come out. I mean, for me, it was a really long process to try and get this out, because it's the secrecy that allows the CIA to get away with such a lot. You know, it gets taken as far as the Congress, maybe parts of it, maybe not. I mean, to this day, I don't know, which is why I wish Senator Feinstein's office would have at least said, we are looking into it, you see? Mm-hmm. And if she had said that, maybe I wouldn't have had to come out with this disclosure, because I would think, okay, someone's going to look into this and there could be some, you know, accountability or something. Of course, on the issue of accountability, that really is wishful thinking, because in the CIA, very few of the senior people are ever held accountable. Everyone's always pointing up to the next person, and then they get into this self-preservation mode.
Yeah. Sabrina, detail for our listeners what you're looking for. What would be a fair resolution of your plight?
Well, I've got a few steps that I can take to resolve it. The government has, in fact, totally abandoned me. I mean, I haven't heard from them from the day I left. I asked my attorney, Mark Zaid, you know, to go check on, well, are they going to do something about these convictions? Not. What's going on? Never heard back. So I'm pretty much on my own on this. So it's going to be my goal to resolve it, to get my name cleared, to have the case against me dropped. So I'm taking Italy to the European Court of Human Rights. I've made an application to them. I have an attorney for them who's working for me pro bono because discussed it as well at the outcome. You've got to know that the final court in Rome, the equivalent of the Supreme Court, the prosecutor there asked for my case to be dismissed for lack of evidence against me. But, you know, whatever political reason, everything was turned upside down, whatever. So right now I'm trying to get my name cleared and get this warrant against me dropped. And, you know, that's the first step in sort of moving on. But I also am looking at the issue of accountability, because I really don't think that, you know, those who approve this should really be able to just get away scot-free. Unfortunately, it's not something that can be dealt with in the U.S. because the case will go nowhere, since all these gentlemen have immunity. So it's possible to look at this something that needs to be taken overseas.
Yeah. And Sabrina, I referenced earlier the term whistleblower, and I've talked to whistleblowers from the NSA, from the CIA, from the DEA, the FBI, and not one of them ever intended to be a whistleblower, never imagined that they would find themselves in that position. Is the same true for you?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was like petrified for such a long time about anything, about what I said and did. In fact, my husband read the article and he goes, holy crap, that's what happened, you know. So even he didn't know what had transpired over there again, because, you know, we grew up in this culture of secrecy and things like that, and, you know, the proper chain and all. But I'm just disappointed about going through the proper, this so often touted, especially in recent times with Bradley Manning and Snowden, not going through the proper channels, especially from the Hill, the very people I went to. I have a long list of senators and congressmen who I approached over there. I went through DOJ to State Department. The last letter was written on November to Secretary Clinton and Michael Posner, who's supposed to be investigating from human rights and democracy, you see, and nothing, zero.
Yeah.
So what's someone to do when it's when the little bit that I was exposing, not compared to, like I mentioned before, that everyone else has done, you know, they're not going to listen to this. And you see the devastation it has caused to everyone but the people who are responsible for that.
Yeah.
That is just simply wrong.
Yeah. And how do you feel about the President of the United States? Barack Obama entered office and said, I'm looking forward, not backward. And the signal to the Justice Department was, don't investigate, don't prosecute any wrongdoing. And I'm offended that, things that I consider to be war crimes were whitewashed at that point. But also, there are people responsible for crimes in the financial sector who I believe have been given a free ride by the Obama Justice Department. So do you believe that there has been obstruction of justice in this loosey-goosey policy of we're looking forward, not backward?
There is to a certain degree, because there are a lot of the conventions that talk specifically about the requirement for an investigation and holding those who don't investigate accountable. That is there. And, you know, the thing is, the thing that concerned me was it was almost like closing a chapter in American history when there were no prosecutions at all, only because from now on, every single president will do the same thing. They'll come in and say, okay, we have to move forward, not back, you know. Because the next set of human rights violations that are going to come up is going to be the drone strikes, right? So so that's the thing. So that seemed like it closed a chapter. It's a very unfortunate chapter in our history where we said, oh, you know, we're just pretty much saying, and it comes down to the arrogance, that, you know, with the United States, we can do this. And, you know, it just, you know, now it suits us to look forward, not back. And then we go and tell the rest of the world, you have to look at your war crimes that you have done, you know, 30 years ago because of, you know, and we hear that so often. But, you know, that to me is the unfortunate and scary thing, that we've allowed that to happen. But you know what? I don't think that will just go away like that. I really don't. Because, you know, the hope and change and the whole world was going rah-rah. The president got the Nobel Peace Prize for it. And I think everyone's turning around and going like, this is unexpected, you know, that we actually got a little bit blindsided over here by what's going on.
My final question to you, Sabrina, is that, as I mentioned, you're a naturalized American citizen. And I've found that new citizens have a strong and often literal interpretation of the Constitution and our system of government. So you devoted your career to serving at the CIA. They have completely abandoned you after you worked through all of the proper channels and followed the defined procedures. You went to Congress, which has the oversight responsibility over the intelligence community. And you have just been stonewalled. You've been ignored and rejected in your appeals. The administration clearly is closing ranks behind the CIA and working to pretend with Italy that when it comes to the top-ranking officials, this event never occurred. And you've already tried the courts and been thrown out of the U.S. courts. So I want to ask you if you still believe in the American system of governance and having been essentially victimized by every branch and the CIA itself, where does that leave you as an American?
A little bit disillusioned, but, you know, Peter, I don't give up that easily and I don't plan on giving it up. I've got another new strategy that I plan to use, and, you know, justice can still be around the corner there. I mean, I may not get my life back, or I may not be, you know, I'll still be without my pension and things like that. But, you know, there are ways of getting around and doing things, and I'm not going to give up. To me, the disappointment has been because, you know, when I was far away in India, I guess, and you look back and go like, wow, the American system of, you know, justice, and you know how it is. It's all like the justice and freedom for all and liberty. And really, when you join the government, you see how the sausage is made. And sometimes that is a little disheartening. And but at the end of the day, you know, it is still like, you know, I don't give up that easily, like I said, and nor do I want to hold this great country accountable for the, you know, the decisions of a few people. So that's the way I look at it, and I don't let it like depress me or demoralize me. I just find that, you know, there is, you know, with every challenge comes a new opportunity, and that's, and something will come out of this.
You present,
and I've got a lot of support. I've got to tell you, people come out of the woodwork to support me on this one.
You present as a very strong person. Has then this been the most difficult period of your life?
I would say so. This is one heck of a challenge that I never in a million years thought would happen to me, you know. I mean, seriously, when you join the government, you don't expect to end up as a convict somewhere, you know. That's horrible. So, again, it's sad, and I wish there was a system now. Another reason I think it's important to get this message out is because there's so many in the government who just think, who have no idea of exactly what happened in the Abu Omar in this whole thing. They think that there was like a screw-up on the street or something like that, but not the duplicity of what happened between back and forth. It's been an eye-opener for them, and they also are all realizing that this diplomatic immunity business doesn't work for them anymore. The government will always protect their own. It's always a self-preservation thing. And the lower-level officers are always going to be the ones who are going to be hung out to dry. That's a message it needs to be reinforced in this, you know, in this whole case. Especially as we move forward, so to say, and we continue engaging in things that are only going to get the lower-level officers in trouble.
Sabrina, every time I release an interview with a whistleblower, I get emails from out of the woodwork, people I've never heard of or heard from before, who have a story to tell and want to know what to do. What do you recommend to the next whistleblower? Should he or she proceed?
Oh, absolutely. If they have something that's wrongdoing and something that needs to be disclosed, they should absolutely proceed, and proceed in the manner in which at least say you tried. You went up to Senator Feinstein's office and tried, and you did your duty in trying. And then, you know, it didn't work. I mean, this my case, especially my disclosures, and I'm getting a lot of calls from human rights groups and things like that, and, you know, American liberties groups and things like that, just because of the fact that I went through the procedure. I went through the proper channel, and the proper channel failed me.
Well, we do need to fix the whistleblower laws, that's for sure. I want to thank you for going public, and thank you for sharing your story with us today. Is there anything you'd like to add as we close?
Oh, nothing else. I think we've covered everything, and I'm really grateful for the support like I've gotten, you know, from people. A lot of people have been, who I don't even know, have been grateful that I've come out with something like this. And at the end, I hope that this disclosure helps the head of the intelligence in Italy, for example, you know, and that both our governments now actually do something about this.
Sabrina D'Souza, CIA whistleblower, we salute you. My sincere thanks to Sabrina D'Souza and for McClatchy reporter Jonathan Landay for helping us connect. And thank you for listening.
Happy trails to you. Until we meet again, happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.